If you've been following our series where Brian Buchanan and I press pause on the Mormon succession crisis, you'll know that we are covering Under the Banner of Heaven for an emergency breakout session where we stopped going in order of the history, which is very hard for me, and we talk about the Hulu series Under the Banner of Heaven. So I'm back with Brian Buchanan. Hi, Brian. Say hello.
Hello, friends. Let's talk.
We want you to go back 2 episodes if you want to learn about the show. I served as one of the official consultants with the help of Brian and his fabulous research. He also helped me with a lot of details of the Lafferty case. And so we thought we'd come and help you break down fact from fiction. Today, we're going to be talking about episode 2. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan,
bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
So our first major scene we get in here is Brigham Young preaching in England, telling people about the wonders of America. Now, this is an interesting scene to show because not only was he not part of the original mission to Britain in 1837, he's actually part of the second wave that goes in 1839. That puts it several years after the Kirtland period, which is most of the historical flashbacks we'll see during this one. So what is the effect of putting Brigham in England to juxtapose here?
Yeah, so that we made some interesting choices there. In the show, you see Brigham Young in Trafalgar. Am I saying that right? Trafalgar?
Mm-hmm.
Square. Now, he actually, it's hard because Trafalgar wasn't even really around then. It was being built at this time, which I didn't know. You know, I don't know anything about English history as a Yankee myself, but we had to learn this. But it was this idea of how do we show something iconic, you know, from the time period so audiences understand that he's not in America. He's saying, come to America. And so that's what that scene is. In reality, Brigham Young, of course, was in different parts of the country, but he was put in this role to show not only the missionary effort, the church is growing, it's starting to develop, but also to showcase the early optimism of the church and this Mormon doctrine of the gathering. How do Mormon pioneers gather and come together? This vision of America tied in with religion is really the Mormon story. And so that scene is to show that Brigham Young is sort of romantic about Mormonism, which why did you make a face when I said that?
Well, that's the being romantic about something. That's one of the hallmarks of someone who has some game, if I'm not mistaken.
He has some game when it comes to converts, unfortunately. But I will give you that. I will give you that, Brighamites.
He seems to be a very charismatic missionary. It would be fascinating to have seen him preaching and see what that's like, because we have a very different view of him from other roles in his life. Brigham as very effective missionary, that would be interesting to see. So then we flash back to Jeb, who's having this very lovely discussion with his daughter who's about to be baptized. And he talks about the idea that baptism will wash away your baby sins, right? And I've seen a couple people talk about that. Mormons don't talk about that way. And I thought, that's another manifestation.
Wait, people said that?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
That was one of those ones that I didn't anticipate would need evidence.
I think someone needs to get out the testimony glove.
Yeah, that was one I thought.
Here is your body, and this glove is your spirit. And when you get born, you put the glove on the hand, and your spirit and body are conjoined. Sometimes the glove touches dirty things and gets sticky and dirty, and you need to wash it. That's what baptism does. It washes it all away. Who says that? I mean, that is how we tell children. Have you never served in nursery?
I thought, or go primary to critics? Any Come baptism on. In any stake center in any part.
Again, when they do that, I think it's just like the first time they've seen themselves manifested on TV, and there's a little bit of like shame or something. I don't know.
And the juxtaposition of Brigham in England and, you know, preaching Mormonism, and then Jeb, baptism in Mormonism is a very interesting idea, because notably Joseph Smith, the way that he frames it is that Mormons don't do original sin, but that Mormons are baptized at the age of 8, because it's known as the age of accountability within Mormon thought. And that was a really valid selling point early on, because that wasn't the idea of original sin, and infant baptism was something that did trouble a lot of people. And so that was something in Mormon thought that was very appealing to a lot of people.
And there's something in Mormon culture where you see their mom is sewing the dresses. We didn't even talk about pioneer dresses, by the way, in the first episode. We're going to have to circle back to that in just a minute. This idea of your baptismal dress being made by your mom, I love that they include that, because that's something like the good moms did, right? Like the good moms sewed their kids.
Pirate family.
My mom had a mix between both. I think I got my baptism dress at a fancy store, but I know that my mom had a lot of pressure to like sew it herself. That was something that good moms did. They sewed clothes for their kids.
We'll forget that we now have stores around us that are perfectly good. It's not like 1860s Utah where
I remember that's not really an option. And I'm a millennial, and when I had babies and I bought the first like commercial Halloween costumes, didn't sew them because I'm a terrible seamstress. It was like I had abandoned my kids on someone else's doorstep. It was like, how could you? Go be capitalist's
kid. And now we go to the police station again, where we're now talking to Robin, and we're using the Tabernacle Choir, which I thought was such a fun element. Do we know, did they ever actually do that? I'm assuming they probably did not in the investigation.
No, was something interesting about that scene, and I'll say this, because I don't know the whole story, so I don't want to, like, you know, say something about the show that is untrue, but I do know that that was like one of the few pieces of Tabernacle Choir music that was fair use that they found. Oh. So that's that choice. But I thought the song choice was perfect. You know, it ended up working. Using music in the show was another issue, and using art, and we can talk about that too. But, you know, FX wanted to play it really safe when talking about Mormonism. And I know that was a free piece of music, but I don't think it was actually used in the investigation.
And that choice of Battle Hymn of the Republic was interesting, because on the one hand, it was the Tabernacle Choir was known for that for decades. I think they won, if I remember, I think they won a Grammy for that. And but
they're no longer the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
I just gave Satan a win there. I apologize. I'm too lazy to say the whole name. I'm lazy.
Is it the choir at Tabernacle Square? What is it now? I can't even remember the choir at Temple Square.
It's, I think, the artist formerly known as the choir.
You know it's what? Like, for the non-Mormon audience, Mormonism is going through an identity crisis right now. It's been a perpetual 200-year identity crisis, but right now it's particularly acute. And so we don't know what to call ourselves or why or how or where.
And then we'll put Under the Banner of Heaven right in the middle of that, too. Good timing. And there was another part of that I think most people will find interesting, is that Robin says this has been going on since 1795. Why did he use that date?
Well, so this is a constitutionalist date. That's what's kind of fun, because if you're a Mormon, you're like, 1795, wait a minute, Mormonism wasn't restored until the 1820s.
What's even to talk about?
Yeah, it's like the world did not exist before 1820. But constitutionalists, however, go back to several dates in the 1700s, and this is just one of them.
Was this 11th Amendment? Is that what it was?
Yeah, because what you have in 1795 is the Jay Treaty and the quarrel over the diplomatic separation of powers, Brian.
Part of the reason that I wouldn't have been a good Lafferty is the finer points of the Constitution bore me to tears.
There's a whole strain of this, and I don't even think we need to go into the 1795 stuff. You can go and throw a dart at the 1700s after 1760s, and you're going to hit a date that matters to constitutionalists, who it's constitutionalist fundamentalism, just like Mormon fundamentalists trying to restore the restoration. These guys are trying to restore these fundamental texts and apparently not the hairstyles of the men that founded America.
Go all the way here.
I agree.
Put a big red, white, and blue pin in that thought, because we'll talk about Dan and that here in episode 3, because that will come back in blazing glory for sure.
The hairstyles?
A little bit. actually, with them, it's more mustaches.
No, it's beards and pioneer dresses in our Mormon universe.
And the idea of Robin being a bishop and seminary teacher, I assume that's kind of, again, the amalgamation of brothers, kind of all of their backgrounds.
Yeah, and it's supposed to show also his identity and commitment to being a good mainstream Latter-day Saint. If you're a seminary teacher, seminary is not the same seminary that's used in other faith traditions. Our seminary,
that's bad and apostate.
That's right. The true restored seminary is given to every high school student in the United States and elsewhere around the world. If you are unfortunate and have to wake up at 6 o'clock to do early morning seminary, and you're basically taught by a guy who could have been an accountant or a GameStop employee, but he chose to be a seminary teacher, and he teaches you the gospel with fun skits, improv, really boring scriptural lectures, and a lot of Mormon ads, if my experience is to be exact.
And usually with a healthy dose of folklore in there.
Yeah, so that's what they were showing with Robin.
Keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere. Stormy weather. Just can't get my poor self together.
What did we know about Alan's level of involvement with School of the Prophets?
That's a good question. I mean, honestly, all of the brothers. That's a really important discussion. As I remember the timeline, Watson Jr., who again in the series kind of gets mushed in with Robin, is the first one that comes in contact with him. And then slowly the other brothers start coming to it. And like Christina and I talked about, obviously they're associated with Onias, Bob Crossfield, for a while, but not all that long. And then they kind of take on their own identity from that. And that's a really interesting thing, because it has a religious Mormon component to it, but it also has this broader anti-tax, anti-government component that is obviously not just in Utah, not just in Utah County, but boy, is it strong there.
Again, I've never met Alan Lafferty myself. I know that Lance had talked with him, but if you listen to Dan, what Dan says about his brother is that Alan was very supportive of his ideas, very supportive of him. Even after the murder, he told his brother he loved him. He told him, you know, that some of the things that you believe are right, you know, like he wasn't. If I'm being generous, because a lot of people want to make this simple and say he's responsible, he should have done something. But again, in these systems, if you know these guys, it's hard when you grow up in a family culture like Alan did. These brothers, you're groomed to believe that they have authority in your life. And that doesn't go away when something tragic happens. It's probably even more confusing then. So I don't know if that's true, but it seems like Alan was on board for a lot of their ideas, at least for a long time.
It does seem like he wasn't as involved as the other brothers, but he was to some degree, I think is probably a fair statement.
And he had grown up with the ideas of his father. And I think the show really shows that tension for him, because I do think Brenda marries into their culture, which is a lot more extreme than the Mormonism she grew up with. She's being exposed to these ideas. So is Alan. He's getting exposed to a new culture. Brenda's dad is a bishop. He has authority and weight in his community. And so Alan is also getting exposed to a new kind of Mormonism, and the show shows that, and I think that that's good, because I think that that did help Alan to not get sucked too far into it.
So now, talking a little bit about Dan, we mentioned last time that Dan had gone to chiropractic school in L.A., following in Watson's footsteps. In fact, the plan was, in 1980, he starts working with Watson, and the plan is that he will eventually take over the practice with the help of Mark. And we kind of saw that introduced in the first episode with the idea of Dan and Robin in the series, who would work together. And what's so interesting is, again, because thanks to these fantastic little local newspapers, we get all sorts of fun little details. And so this article, when Dan kind of starts his work, They describe him as a, quote, specialist in nutrition and ecology, which is an interesting blend. And he had plants.
That means grass.
Yeah. That's when that grass is those ideas. Like
It does mean like these herbal natural remedies, which, by the way, non-Mormons and non-Utahns is a huge thing here. We have two very big, some of the biggest essential oil MLMs or businesses are in Utah.
And not even just Utah, even the farther up the Mormon corridor, Tara Westover's parents. That's their real life business is essential oils and things like that. So that's
A lot of fundamentalists we know are in the essential oil business. It's big, big, big money for fundamentalists.
And Dan's plan, he was going to have this ecology control facility that would, quote, deal with the whole picture of natural health, especially in connection with the relation of how environment and nutrition affect our health. So when we see how they're the next generation, Dan and Robin in the practice, they've got these new ideas. That's kind of what we're getting at, is they've got these broader goals of what to do with chiropractics that weren't necessarily things that their father had done. So that is definitely true to life.
And I do think, you know, they're especially around that time when we should talk about this sometime on the podcast. But there were ideas developing in this tension between science and I don't know, religious beliefs in the 1970s and 80s and 90s. This was a struggle going on. So this idea of natural medicine and, you know, medical institutionalized medicine really starts to happen in this time period. And so I think that's reflective in the series as well.
So then on the other hand, we've mentioned you've got Ron charting his own path. He's working in construction. He's on the one hand fairly successful, but he's also kind of stretching himself far beyond his energies and capacity. And so we'd start to see that introduced. But then, I've talked to Lindsay about this. In my head, I always picture Ron and Dan as being like these really weird, nerdy dudes, which weird, yes, they become. But these are also, you know, traditionally successful people. They're football players and they're charismatic and they have government positions. I mean, these were people who attracted others to them. So that's the picture that I've always had in my head really got challenged by looking into it more. And then we also have Ron as a city councilman. And again, thanks to the newspaper articles about this, you really see Ron's solid sense of right and wrong. And if he thought something was right to double down on, he did not care the consequences. He would follow his convictions no matter what.
Like this beer case, right? When he tries to get beer banned. So there's this long history with what we call the Word of Wisdom, a Mormon health code, where, you know, different interpretations are based on every family. Honestly, every family has its own like weird.
No Mormon wouldn't eat fries.
yeah. We got to talk about the fry situation too. But the Lafferty's, of course, had a more extreme version. This idea of no chocolate. It comes from this strain, I think, where a lot of naturalists, herbalists in Mormon culture don't eat a lot of sugar or refined sugar or anything like that. They want it very natural. And so this idea that he would be fighting beer liquor laws is very much in line with this Mormon arc. And it's just something that like good Mormon leadership looks like, right? We don't bring alcohol, which is a danger, into our communities.
So then after all these scenes, we get some really good historical flashback scenes. So we go to Kirtland, and one that has got a lot of people wondering is, of course, the story where the dog gets killed. And while that is not a real scene, the themes that it introduces definitely are. That Kirtland, just like it happened in New York, Mormons in Kirtland start to enter into conflicts with their neighbors. And that, I mean, happens every place that Mormons touch. But Kirtland, we do see a lot of that. So yes, that specific story that's portrayed was not a real story, but speaks to some larger themes.
Yeah, so I had to do research on that, and that was tricky. First of all, the biggest inaccuracy, I think, in the show with Kirtland is that Kirtland doesn't look like that. Kirtland is very green at any time of year. There's a lot of trees. I've been there during the winter, and it's just trees everywhere. Of course, we filmed in Calgary, so it was different. We had this fictional town, but we had to show the early beginnings of the church. And, you know, when I was doing the research, it was very specific. It was like they didn't have covered wagons in Kirtland. That was not the style of wagons that they were using, especially for the sort of migration that they were doing. And so even though they, you know, they used covered wagons for a few reasons in the show, and but the level of research, we knew the wagons, we knew the weapons they were carrying, all that kind of stuff. At the beginning, one of the things that they had in the script was Kirtland Temple to show that it's Kirtland, but we were able to take it out and put it at the end so it's closer to a timeline, because the Kirtland Temple was only the last few years of their experience. But when they're moving in, they're building the town, and you see that. You see construction happening. Joseph is overlooking this town, and that's meant to sort of be sort of a metaphor for them building their trying to build their own Zion. And this moment with the dog, it is fictional. That was one of the very few scenes that is completely made up in the history. And we did that because we needed to show, first of all, this tie-in to fundamentalism and the dogs, because a lot of fundamentalists do have these weird folklore stories about Joseph Smith that aren't true. Like, you know, it's George Washington and the apple tree or whatever. Is it George or Abraham Lincoln?
Washington, and it's a cherry tree.
Cherry tree. Come on now. What is Lincoln's? He has one too. Corn cob pipe. Who knows? Something. We do this with our characters, and fundamentalists do too. So this idea that they were pulling from the history was that. And, you know, I actually researched to see if there's anything with Joseph Smith and dogs. Christopher C. Smith found an incident with a dog. There, we found an incident where a hog was like killed and threatened and butchered in Nauvoo. So there were stories that are analogous to this, but it was, like you said, meant to portray an overall narrative.
And the idea of financial problems again, and the whole Kirtland flashback scene obviously had to be telescoped like everything else. So it's incorporating elements that are actually more from the Missouri period. And we're having, for time constraints and storytelling purposes, all these things, squishing things down to get a cohesive scene.
Yeah. So in the scene, it takes place in Kirtland, Ohio, and the guy is talking, you know, the guy that is holding up this dog to kill this dog, this kid's dog, is really like a Missouri period sort of guy, right? Not that there wasn't conflict in Kirtland, because there was plenty of that. But sort of that tone and tenor is meant to represent this sort of mob mentality that is developing. And what I think is funny is, outside of the Mormon history world, most Mormons wouldn't have seen that as inaccurate at all. They would just be like, this is how it happened. Because I think that's how a lot of Mormons, mainstream Mormons, understand it as well. And it was also meant to not just show the dog analogy with, you know, the Lafferty family and this conflict that the Mormons are developing, but to show that Joseph Smith had this kindness, this sort of like, you know, he stands in for the boy. Joseph Smith actually did put his personal body and property on the line a lot for people. And that is sort of what adhered people to Joseph. They liked that about him. So it was important to show a moment where he's sort of stepping in, and to show that Brigham Young is coming in and saying, let's respond, you know, harsher. And Joseph's like, no, not yet.
Not yet. We'll get there. Not quite yet, though. But the overall theme of persecution is really what seeps out of that. And of course, that's important because Robin is the one telling this. And he's the one who is now explaining to Jeb why the Laffertys and those around them have these violent anti-government feelings.
And I want to point out, if you're really paying attention to the Mormonism that these narrators are positioned at, Robin is telling a story that he would have understood from the mainstream perspective. So his telling is a mainstream perspective, which shows up in the series.
And then he will tie it, obviously, to this more extreme anti-tax, anti-government thing. And in real life, there's a group that, a fairly small group from what I understand, called Patriots United for Freedom, which of course is PUF. When you pick a name, get a good acronym to go
with. My favorite was a newspaper article where they misidentified the group and got the acronym wrong, and then they had to issue a correction. Did you see that?
I didn't see that.
Oh, I can't. I wish I could remember the original acronym. It's funny.
Oh, that's great. So in looking at it, the earliest I could see that specific group mentioned was in 1981, but then you see it more in 1982 because Dan will choose to run for sheriff on a write-in campaign that we will talk about in great detail next time, because wow, that is really, I think, where Dan's extremism gets stoked, is during that sheriff campaign, and with some other things mixed in there. Now, do we have any, you know, we get this great scene of Taba finding this something being burned in the backyard, and it's clear that it's important. Do we know that, did that ever happen with any of the brothers in real life?
I actually don't know the answer to that. I do know that some of the fundamentalist texts and pamphlets were like hidden or destroyed. You know, there was an effort to get rid of them, mostly out of shame. I don't think it was an obstruction of justice issue. I actually don't know that. I don't think that that was, it didn't show up in my research.
That was one I felt was probably a, just kind of a dramatic device, but worked really well.
I'd never tell a man to ask my daddy for my hand. I've got a thousand tales about the temper of that man.
And then we start to see what's happening now that the parents are gone on the mission, and Dan and Robin, in real life, obviously Mark had kind of partnered with him, that now take over the practice. And we see that, like we talked about, they have kind of some broader goals, and that really does become a problem because of Dan's extreme anti-tax and licensing and all these things. That is real. And it does get to the point while their parents are on their mission that things are going to be seized.
Well, not just that, it was during a period of recession. That was a real thing going on too. And I think that that's an important component to recognize, that these things happen, including original Mormonism, started in a big nationwide recession. And a lot of fundamentalism is really amplified then. We talked about this, you know, when a Democrat runs for president or becomes president, fundamentalists will really gun up, you know, get a lot of weapons, practice drills. And we're seeing it right now during the pandemic. There's this rise in this sort of constitutionalist fundamentalism. There's this uncertainty and this fear. People adhere to literalism, to fundamentalism. It's the only surety that they can. And I think that that is a huge part of what was happening with the Laffertys. They were suffering. Chiropractics businesses were not essential. And construction, you know, that was another recession that you see. And so that was absolutely accurate.
And sort of a related thing to that is at this point where the rigid patriarchal structure and the overt misogyny that we see within the family begins to ramp up. And we don't want to tip our hand too much, but we're going to talk more about this. They are introduced to the peacemaker, and that really gives them some tools to ramp that up. We'll talk about that specifically later on, because that was a revelation, I think, to most people, that that was a real document and that in real life, the Laffertys did find that. And that apparently impacted them a lot.
And it's really hard in Mormon culture where, especially as a woman, where sometimes, I mean, you really are at the mercy of the priesthood culture of different people you interact with. In my family, it was very laid back. My mom was more of the head of the household. And I just thought that meant all women could be, right? Because that was the reality for me. And then when I met more patriarchal Mormons, they would tell me things like, you're not allowed to call on the blessing. A man has to do that. You're not allowed to say who can pray. You're not allowed to do this and this and this. And I thought, yes, I am. I've done it before. No one had a problem with it then. And when that comes into conflict, and it did for me a few times in my life, you would go to your priesthood leader. And unfortunately, the old Mormon texts back up this behavior. So there's nothing to really repudiate these old ideas. They keep showing up being repeated. And almost, if you can trace it back to the original guys, to Joseph or Brigham, it carries the most weight of all. It doesn't matter who, you know, said it now. Even if it was beloved President Hinckley, you could argue Joseph Smith said it, it carries more weight.
And obviously, as you get into the more fundamentalist end of Mormonism, that becomes increasingly important, that those ideas come from that time period.
Exactly. And so this is why it's so difficult, this tension between like Brenda's family and the Laffertys family, because you can see in the show, Brenda doesn't have a lot of institutional support, because at the end of the day, these texts that the fundamentalists are looking to still exist in our canon, even if they're sort of hidden or not talked about.
And because she is away from her family, they're up in Idaho, she doesn't have their on-site support as much. She has to go it alone, and that's much more difficult. And like you pointed out, you know, these kind of versions of Mormonism coming in conflict. We see that when then Alan goes up to Idaho to meet her family. And he's now having to say out loud kind of how his brothers and he see things. And he can see very clearly that Brenda's dad doesn't love this. And that's a really important scene.
I love that portrayal, because I do know men like Brenda's dad who, thank goodness for them, because they were the men that helped protect us girls from some of the bad stuff. You know, I've been in situations in my ward, family, or community where we had a leader who was a fundamentalist patriarch, and, you know, allowed for things that he shouldn't have allowed for, made girls feel a certain way. And then you'd have a guy like Brenda's dad step in and sort of counteract that. And it didn't happen very often, but it happened enough that I can recognize good men in the church like Brenda's dad, who he was a bishop. There were some bishops that didn't use their power to subjugate women. And I think Brenda was really lucky in that way.
I thought it was so telling how he describes these ideas as dusty. That was a very good choice. And I thought it was interesting that you see Alan, he's got that book, How to Beat the Bears, which is not a real book.
I think it's just a text. Yeah, it's probably a tax text. I don't know where they got that, actually.
But of course, he thinks that, is this investment? And Alan has to say, actually, no, this is more of my dusty ideas, basically. And that dad's eyebrows continue to go up. And then part of this whole discussion of the different cultures coming in conflict is, of course, the story we see with Brenda at KBYU, a very gross episode, but also cool because we see Brenda winning ultimately.
Yeah, I think this was an important scene for her character arc to show that she was not afraid to stand up for herself, but it's that issue that gets her in trouble ultimately. What I love about her character arc is when the investigation first happens, the men assume it must be because she's beautiful, right? They're like, well, you know, that's a very Mormon patriarchal idea. And a part of Jeb's character is like rooting out this toxic patriarchy within himself. But within Brenda, this is a real struggle for her. So while the scene with the professor is fictionalized, Brenda complains in her journals and diaries that she was not taken seriously because of her looks. She was hit on by professors. She wanted to be taken seriously and people kept treating her like she wasn't. So she did deal with harassment. She did deal with these issues and it didn't play out like this professor. I think, you know, she had a good professor. It was meant to show what she was up against, which when I heard Mormon feminists online were like saying, you know, this was not accurate. It would have never happened. Women in broadcasting were doing just fine. It was like, have you talked to women in broadcasting? Because women in broadcasting now still have to deal with these issues. Like,
rewind it a couple decades.
That is so interesting to me that they were saying that, because I've been a Mormon woman in the professional space for a while now, and it has not been pretty or easy the way that people treat you. Men and women don't take you seriously, especially because of how you look. So to me, that rang very, very true. And I'm glad that they're showing that arc. It's going to come, you know, as you see this story develop, it becomes an important, I hate to say this, problem for Brenda, as it does for a lot of women with ambition and talent, and who are pretty in Mormonism. Those things intersect in ways that aren't good for women in patriarchal cultures.
And we see, you know, obviously in real life, she had seen the example of Michelle King, who had been a graduate of the program, who then gone on to be a local, much beloved anchor on a local station here. But then also we see that she apparently was offered a position to teach at BYU. But because she had committed to Alan and the stay-at-home mom career, that was dashed. And so we see a kind of a window of a much larger story that happens in real life that played out like that.
And here's the thing. I've talked to Mormon women who feel like, you know, motherhood being treated as less than or a cage, as the show says, is disrespectful to motherhood. But the reality is, in our culture, there is an expectation that the mothers are the primary caretakers. I think it's changing a little bit culturally first, but not really. Like, it's still very much part of the cultural fabric. For example, I, you know, was a youth in the 90s, basically. So after Brenda would have done it. And all of our activities were gendered. We learned how to do domestic arts. We learned how to cook. We learned how to be better homemakers, to make cookbooks, to learn how to make diapers and change diapers and fold diapers. The boys weren't learning that. They were learning something else. And so this idea that she's staying at home, it's more than just about a choice. It's about a life path being predetermined for you as the right choice, as the feminist choice. And that causes a lot of women pain. I know it personally. I know the struggle of having to be a professional with kids. It's not something that was sold to me in an accurate way, I think. It depended on me being provided for always by a husband who made enough to support me. And when that doesn't happen, as it doesn't happen for most households in this modern age, it's a hard thing. So that was weird that people were criticizing that, you know,
it didn't feel true.
It didn't feel true. It was like, it was, but it was like functionally, physically true for Brenda. You can't really do both. especially not in that industry in the 1980s. Although I did see, I won't name her, but there was a prominent newscaster that I saw when I was working, you know, downtown. She came into the department store with her daughter. And I remember being shocked that this woman on news had a daughter and then judging her and thinking she must not be a very good mom. Because I know, you know, she's this famous newscaster. She must have chose that over her daughter.
It's hard to fight those ideas. They're so entrenched. Back now at the police station, we start getting more explanations of how the brothers are seen, and they mention that Ron and Dan had both been excommunicated. And obviously, this is fast-forwarding a little bit to when the murder happens, and that's true. So Ron had been brought by before the High Council in 1983 and excommunicated, and we thought it was so interesting. Later in his obituary in the New York Times, they said, quote, "The events leading to the killings began in 1983 when Mr. Lafferty was excommunicated." Yeah, no. By the time he gets excommunicated, things are moving full speed ahead. So I'll push back there. And Dan had actually been excommunicated the year before. And his is, oh boy, he's trying to marry his wife's stepdaughter, or well, her daughter, his stepdaughter, who's 14, as a plural wife.
Yeah, that really happened. People were asking about the abuse and stuff. And unfortunately, it did happen. And again, this is more common than people realize, unfortunately, that doctrines of polygamy and some of these old doctrines are used to justify molestation by step-parents that...
But it's a stepdaughter, so it's somehow better.
Man, you know, it's so funny when you look at the old pioneer records. When I was thinking about this idea the other day, there's this discussion in Mormonism when we justify past polygamy. It's like, oh, that... Or underage marriage. I'll be like, it was how it was back then. That was the times. That's how it is now. People still marry their 14-year-old stepdaughters. That still happens now. Now, just like it happened then. It wasn't that different, and it wasn't a different time, and it's not a different time now. People thought it was bad then. They think it's bad now. And it unfortunately is used, like Dan used it, to justify. Again, it's more common than people realize, unfortunately.
That didn't ring true to me.
I hope not.
Sadly,
I hope for most people it doesn't.
Hopefully you haven't, but just because you haven't run into it definitely does not mean that it's not happening.
It was hard for me when I started Year of Polygamy to start hearing those stories, because it was seminary teachers, it was stepdads, it was doctors, it was bishops, it was mission presidents, you know? Anytime you have these vulnerable girls saying, I have a revelation that my sexual attraction to you is justified by God, and by the way, you have to listen to it too. Like that happened more times than it ever should have in our community, unfortunately.
So at least minor good news. They heard about it, took it seriously, and excommunicated him. Fortunately, that just kind of added more fuel to the fire. And now this is kind of a touchy point I'd like to talk about now, but it does seem like that with all this going on, it does seem like Alan was at least aware of particularly Ron's intense hatred for Brenda. And
well, Dan says he told Ron about the revelation. I mean, he claims that he told Alan, hey, heads up, you know, I don't know what it means, but I'm going to, like, God wants, you know, her destroyed. And I think there was a recent interview released of Dan where he said something like, again, it was 16 years after the fact, so his memory changes. So does his narrative. But he claimed that Alan said, well, I'll do what I have to do and defend my family if I have to, but I don't want to get in the way of God's work. And of course, this is Dan Lafferty saying that. But I do think, yeah, he knew about it. And this is a testament to the casual violence of Mormonism. This stuff is so normalized. People have to realize this. There is this discourse in Mormonism about people who revelate and have personal revelation that we let a lot of crazy stuff go. And every mainstream Mormon, I don't care who you are, you've had an experience where someone has gone off the rails at testimony meeting. That happens. That happens in every congregation. And so I can sympathize with Alan thinking, you know, maybe it was one of those moments, because it's so normalized for people to go extreme in the name of religious personal revelation.
Revelation. That's the thing I was going to say, is when you attach that specific word to something, that really muddies the waters.
I mean, I don't want to sit there and justify the complacency. And of course, like, I'm horrified to know that he knew about this and didn't do anything. I mean, this story is a failure on so many levels, right? But I just think that this is one of the issues, the invitations of the show for our community to look at how casually we dismiss this stuff. You know, like you said, you attach revelation to it. People can say all kinds of nonsense. I had some guy get up at our ward council meeting and start talking about this dream he had about the Star of David crashing down and couldn't follow his logic. I didn't know enough about the Old Testament, but it was strange. And we all just let him do it. And no one thought, something going on with that guy at home. You know, no one thought about that.
And that's another discussion that's been happening is, you know, is this a religious case? Is this a domestic violence case? And the answer, of course, is it's all of it and a whole lot more. And obviously, we're recording this in the wake of yet another horrific shooting, but not an inexplicable one. We know that there were signs that he had threatened violence against women beforehand. That was ignored. And so we see that again here, just in now more of a religious setting, where there were clear signs of misogyny, of domestic abuse, all of this, that again, like you said, it's a failure.
Yeah, I just want to talk from a personal experience. So in my ward, I'll just say Tooele broadly, there was a woman whose husband was in the bishopric, and they were the golden couple. I mean, beautiful to look at, both of them, just absolutely beautiful. And he started having a revelations about her that he wrote in his journal, and they were violent. And they included a pistol and a handgun, and I can't remember all the details now. She went and took it to the bishop, and he dismissed it. He said, no way. He actually brought the husband in and asked her.
I know him. He's a good man.
The guy retaliated, and it ended up in a very physical, awful situation, and she had to escape. And I remember at the time knowing what she was saying was true, but not being able to wrap my head around this good guy in our bishopric, and kind of wanting to, my urgent instinct was to defend the bishop for defending him. That's how this works. And this happened in my own ward, and she was faithful. And yet we thought her questioning her husband was somehow a lack of faith on her part, and it wasn't. She went to the bishop. She didn't go to the police. That's an evidence of her faith. And I think it's more common than we realize, unfortunately.
Time for another flashback scene, and this one we're going to have to ask you to saddle up. So this is the scene of Joseph Smith getting dragged out of his house, and there's a lot going on with this one.
Lead us in, Brian.
Yeah. So let's go back to 1832. So we did talk about this in the non-banner podcast. What are we going to call it now?
A few episodes back.
900 years ago. So Joseph and Emma are living at the farm of John and Elsa Johnson in Hiram, Ohio, near Kirtland. One night, Joseph gets dragged out, apparently to be killed, but then the group kind of talks themselves out of that. So let's
Can I tell you something funny about the script really quick? So every time this would come up in the script, it would just say like Kirtland, Ohio, and I would go in and I would change it Hiram, Ohio. Every time, Kirtland, Hiram, Ohio. It would never show up on screen, but to me, I was like, but you need to know.
It's Hiram, not Kirtland. They're two specific places here. It's like, you know, if somebody comes in.
A few miles apart.
Somebody's like, this happened in West Rockwell. You're like, nice try, dude. This is East Rockwell.
Yeah, I just,
different story.
I hope people realize what a crazy perfectionist the trauma of this community has instilled in both of us. You have to be so precise in your Mormonism, or people will come at you and say you did your prayer hands wrong.
All right, so let's talk about the sources we have for this. The thing is, we don't actually have really any contemporary sources for it. Joseph Smith isn't keeping a journal yet. He will write an account of it, but that's not until 1843 when they're working on the history project. And if for some reason that's like, ooh, that sounds interesting, let me remind you, we did a whole series about his history in Deseret Dramas. So in this 1843 account that he writes, they're going to kill him and Sidney, but they kind of decide not to. It seems like what they did is they brought nitric acid, or aqua fortis, they called it at that time, and they were kind of dump it down their throats, which would have bare minimum really messed them up, if not kill them. But then it gets kind of downgraded to this gnarly tar and feathering episode.
I'll talk about why we included it. You can talk about the history of it. I mean, we can talk about both. But really, this was put in to show a few things. First of all, we had to show that Joseph was starting to have some conflict, perhaps in his marriage, perhaps with outsiders, about other women. And this is important, not only because it is true, like we're going to talk about the, you know, Mormon historians are like, it didn't happen that way. We don't know if it was about a girl. And to that, I say, But it's not like we didn't know Joseph Smith had problems with young ladies or allegations, because there were plenty of those. And I actually would not be surprised at all if there was a woman involved in this particular allegation. Do you want to talk about what the general consensus is?
So we have two main sources here. So first we have 1864, Luke Johnson, who will, a few years after this episode, become an apostle. And he's the son of the John and Elsa where they're staying. He writes in an autobiographical sketch that the mom here, I'm not going to say mob because I don't like that word, because that immediately paints them as bad and evil. So
it was a small group of people.
They had planned to castrate Joseph Smith, but then didn't. He doesn't really assign a motive. He just says that's what happened. Then, 20 years later, you have a man named Clark Braden who claimed that, quote, the mob was led by Eli Johnson, who blamed Smith for being too intimate with his sister Mirinda, who afterward married Orson Hyde. Okay, now this account is wrong on one little detail, because Mirinda didn't have a brother named Eli, but she did have an uncle. It's the brother of her father, John Johnson, and it does seem like this Eli was there that night. So, okay, it's wrong, but it's not like wildly wrong. Now, a couple thoughts about this account. Clark Braden was a Disciples of Christ minister. So if you remember right before we started this banner series, when we talked about Sidney Rigdon and Alexander Campbell and that whole environment, that's this part of Christianity. And he is debating an RLDS guy on a whole bunch of different things. And this particular speech was designed to show that Joseph Smith was both the originator of polygamy and, kind of more fundamentally, he was just a slimy dude. He talks about all these allegations from New York. He talked about how one of Joseph Smith's sisters got pregnant and had to leave in disgrace. So, and also you have to remember, as part of this mixture, that one of the basic principles of RLDS identity at that time was that Joseph Smith was, of course, not a polygamist. So you've got all that going on. And so Braden tells all sorts of stories. Some of them are just bogus. And also, because of the situation, he's very motivated to exaggerate details. So that's where we get, as far as I can tell, the first time that the castration is tied to Mirinda and some improprieties there.
So, and here's the other complicated thing. Later on in Joseph's life, Mirinda Hyde is brought into this plural marriage stuff. And so there are different ages for Mirinda that place her. I saw, you know, in the sources, she's as young as 9 years old to 17 years old or whatever. I think, and when we had discussions on how old to cast this actor who shows up as a teenage girl in this scene, they chose to go with an older girl to sort of represent the later Mirinda. Now, to the castration issue, I think it's entirely plausible that people knew that detail, that she was a later plural wife of Joseph Smith, and, you know, reappropriated that as a castration issue. It's possible that Joseph Smith there wasn't an attempted castration at the time. I can allow for that. However, I do think that it is still within integrity of the story to show that Joseph Smith had allegations of young women and sexual crimes. Castration was often used as a punishment, as we will see in Frontier Utah when Mormons employed it on other Mormons for sexual crimes.
And I mean, obviously in Kirtland, the Fanny Alger debacle, which I think everyone agrees something happened there, that's only a couple years away. So that's...
And if Grant Palmer's to be believed, he has allegations of Joseph visiting brothels at a young age. Like, this was in line with frontier culture. We look back at Mormons as these like pious Quakers. That is not who Joseph Smith was. He was disrupting the Quaker game. He was a rough and tumble frontier kid. Have you lived with rural country boys? Do you know how they act? It's not prim and proper all the time. And so it makes sense that Joseph Smith was fooling around.
And part of this story of why it's so contentious is because, of course, this story then later reappears from an author named Von Brody in a book called No Man Knows My History. And if you think John Krakauer is a swear word, Von Brody is a much worse swear word.
She's the outer darkness of curse words, so much so that a lot of Mormons don't even know who she is.
And again, you know, after she includes it, people are like, but she didn't have a brother named Eli. And of course, Von Brody is Satan, and it just gets all blown out of proportion. And we're here to say, everybody calm down. This story is, I think, by all accounts, definitely not implausible. So
no. And so, you know, when we did this scene, I want to talk about this because I did a lot of work on this scene, and the work was the dialogue. We changed it to be how it was originally written Lance gave me a lot of flexibility with who said what and how they did it. And so we have this doctor holding this knife to imply the castration scene, but not ultimately castrating him because he wasn't castrated. And to show that the tar and feather, they had hot molasses in a bucket. So that was such an interesting night for me because it was at the end of the day, we had shot some Joseph and Emma scenes and it's cold. And I'm in this room with Joseph and Emma in their nightgowns and we're going over details of this history in depth, right? And you're just seeing very, very small things. So the idea was, we know Joseph Smith was in a trundle bed with one of his twins. The Mormon story is because the mob pulls them out, leaves the breeze open, and the child ends up getting sick from the mob and dies, which some version of that did happen. One of their twins died shortly after, one of their adopted twins. So we have the baby in that scene. It's very brief. And I'll never forget Andrew Burnap. Just in between takes, there was an actual baby in the bed and he was like playing with it. You know, it was kind of this sweet moment. And then watching him get dragged out over and over and over again in the cold and having his clothes like ripped off of him. And he did it all himself. There were no stunts. And then Tyner's, you know, really emotional scene. The weirdest part for me was seeing the mobs, this mob men with their torches walk past, like something in my Mormon DNA just kind of like bristled every time that I saw that.
And that's very important because that's what we take away from this is whatever actually happened, the way that Mormons will see that is as a story of persecution, one of many, right? That's the purpose of it. And so all the details, something, I mean, obviously they were attacked and they were tarred and feathered and it was incredibly traumatic to them. And it was interpreted as persecution. That's the meat of it.
And also there are some fundamentalists who believe that Nancy Mirinda Hyde was involved.
It's Mirinda Nancy Hyde. How dare
Mirinda
you switch her those names?
Mirinda Nancy Hyde was involved and that he was rightly involved with her and he should have been and that he was being persecuted for that. So that's also in line with how Alan tells the story.
And then, of course, in that the extended flashback then we see the kind of the end of Kirtland. And again, because we're kind of squishing things together, Joseph Smith in the historical record actually leaves Kirtland with Brigham Young, not Emma, which is very interesting because I've always thought it's not Joseph Smith's most heroic hour. He just kind of leaves Emma and everyone and just gets out of town.
Yeah. So that scene too, I mean, part of me was like, wrong wagons. It wasn't quite like that. But there's this narrative that has to show that there's this change from Joseph Smith to Brigham Young. And that was one of the challenging parts of history because that change is absolutely true. Every Mormon knows it. Brigham and Joseph were two separate people. They ran the church in two separate ways. But to show how we get those details, we kind of have to like fudge the history a little bit. And to show that there's a conflict between Emma's Mormonism and Brigham's Mormonism, which is absolutely true as well.
And obviously some of the elements that you see there are definitely more Missouri elements. The more militant rhetoric, you know, this Joseph Smith, we don't have him saying as he leaves Kirtland, we're going to tread upon the ashes of the wicked. It's a biblical phrase, but and that fits more with Missouri. But again, you don't have, this isn't.
But after the persecution, Joseph does start adopting violent rhetoric. That is true. And it was influenced partially by Brigham Young. Also
yes.
True. So those elements, even though the timeline are a little fudgy, and that's when you see the Kirtland Temple, you'll notice.
What color is it?
It's blue. That's Renee Reed's team did such great research and I got to do work on that. And it was blue. Why? Why, Brian?
Because your ancestors gave their best china for it.
There was china in the plaster, but it was probably just from the trash heap. But our apocryphal faith folklore story is that they sacrificed all their best china for the Kirtland Temple. It did have a blue sheen on it, and the roof was kind of this red color at first. And over time, it's been whitewashed, and just like a lot of Mormon history. And now it looks a little different, but we wanted to show that it's sort of the end of that era and into a new sort of more violent era. And
very ominous the way that it's done, which is important because if Brigham Young takes away one lesson from Kirtland, it's I'm not going down like that. I'm not going to give dissenters any room to grow and fester.
And you do, you know, at this time period, we're getting into the Missouri period with the
Zion's Camp.
Zion's Camp is happening around this time and it's really starting to ramp up and becomes one of the most violent periods of Joseph Smith's lifetime. And so we had to sort of lead to that. And as you're watching that, you're seeing the Lafferty brothers sort of radicalize themselves. So yeah, I think that that's a good wrap of two. Like we said, we're going to get into the case of the murder soon. We're sort of balancing it with giving away too many spoilers in case people aren't caught up. And we're going to talk about Brenda in more detail too. If this is your first time listening, go back and start at episode one and you can catch all the way up. We've got 69 episodes now at this point, which will get you through a lot of Mormon history and you can become a Mormon history nerd. Also, we would love you to join us at the Sunstone Symposium, July 27th through the 30th at the Mountain America Expo Center in Sandy, Utah. If you're a fan of the podcast, if you're a fan of Mormonism, if you're a fan of the show, come check it out. We have you can register at sunstone.org and come to a conference where we talk all things Mormon. It's a lot of fun. And if you're enjoying the podcast, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a good review, and donating at sunstone.org.
As part of the symposium, we will have a trivia contest again this year with literal nerd hats. And if you think there's not going to be some banner-related questions in there, better think again.
We need
again.
To do a whole banner round.
That would actually be really fun.
Yeah, get ready out there. Who was our team that did so well last time?
I can't remember who won.
Julianne Briscoe. You got to take it this time. Take it all the way.
Spill my blood upon the earth, oh brother Brigham, brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, brother Brigham, brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, brother Brigham, brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, brother Young. That only you can save me, brother Brigham, brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.